Eric Cusin, founder and CEO of hashtag Same Here Global.
What inspired you to create Same Here Global?
Long story. So do you tell me how...
We have tons of time, yes.
Okay. Well, was a professional sports executive for 15 years, worked at the NBA league office, worked for the Chicago Sky, which was the first ever independently owned WNBA team outside of NBA ownership. From there, went out to Phoenix with the Phoenix Suns and the Phoenix Mercury and became their director of sales and service. Back east to New York to become the VP of sales and service for the New Jersey Devils. So I was living in New York, but working for the Devils at the time. And then down to Florida as their chief revenue officer. So the Panthers, the team that's in the Stanley Cup final right now. And 6 months into my tenure, my brain and my body gave out of me. I didn't know where it came from. And I went through a pretty awful 2.5 year hellish period, which I can certainly go into more detail on if you'd like. You tell me when we're ready to go. But for now, I'll give the top line of it. And I tried every medication known to man. 52 different psychotropic drug combinations. I did TMS therapy, where they shoot electromagnetic waves into your brain to try to wake up your synapses and get them firing. And I went inpatient to a psych ward and had ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, or we know it in the movies as shock therapy. And unfortunately, left the hospital after 12 sessions over 5 weeks of the shock therapy, no better than I had the 2.5 years prior, thinking my life is over unless Merck or Pfizer invents a miracle pill that pops me out of it and makes me better, because I'm this thing called treatment resistant. And what ultimately ended up happening was I met a practitioner who practiced something called integrative psychology. I didn't know what the term integrative meant. And so I sat in her office, and I was expecting the appointment to go the way that most mental health appointments go, which is, "Hi, Michael, nice to meet you. What are your symptoms?" And you list them. "Hi, Michael, based on your symptoms, here's your diagnosis." And you're diagnosed with everything from ADHD to PTSD to OCD to depression to anxiety. And then based on your diagnosis, here's how we treat you. And it's some kind of combination of medication and talk therapy, medication and talk therapy. That's what my expectation was. And that's not what ended up happening. What ended up happening was the woman sat me on the couch and said, "Eric, the couch is your one-person stage, and I'm your one-person audience. And I want you to answer one question for me over the next hour, and I don't want to ask another question. And that question is, what's the story of your life as you tell it to yourself? And there's no rules. You could scream, you could curse, you could yell, you could punch a pillow, you could look at the wall instead of look at me, you could go in order, you could go out of order." And the background there is, for the next hour, this isn't the only thing I shared, but this is a good meat of it, is from the time I was 8 years old until 23, this is what my life looked like. My older brother, so I'm the middle of three boys, he broke his femur bone and was put into a body cast for a year and homeschooled. Healed from that, and a month later got diagnosed after going back to school, because he's healthy now, but gets diagnosed with ALL, which is a children's form of leukemia. So 5 years of chemo and radiation in the late 80s, early 90s, not the best prognosis, but miracle, he goes into remission after 5 years. We're all celebrating. A month later, he's in a Jeep Wrangler with his friends, open top, no seatbelt in the back. Car loses control. He flies out of the back, lands on his head, cracks his orbital bone, loses partial vision in his eyes, and ICU for a month. Heals from that, goes to college, feeling a pain in his knee. Same cancer from childhood's come back. Now that it's come back, they have to give him a stronger dose of the chemo, which does a great job on lowering their white blood cell counts, but unfortunately what it also does is it impacts the way that he's feeling, because it impacts a lot of the healthy cells, and his body develops 105 fever. We take him to the hospital, goes into septic shock from the chemo treatment, septic shock, he falls into a coma, and now he's in a coma for 3 months. We have no idea if he's going to wake or have any brain activity. Miracle, he wakes, full cognitive faculties, but his kidneys fail from being in the septic shock for so long. So he needs to go on dialysis. We all get tested to see who's the closest match. My father is, donates a kidney to him. That's all successful. I get that first job at the NBA league office that I described earlier, thinking blank slate, real world, put it all behind me. And within that first couple of years, There's my dog moving in the background. Three of my close friends pass away back to back to back of either misdiagnosed or undiagnosed cardiovascular conditions. And so I share that because the doctor stopped me at that point, and this will lead to why I started the organization. She stopped me 50 minutes into the hour-long session, and she said, "Eric, I told you you could talk for an hour. I wouldn't interrupt you, but there's only 10 minutes to go. What else happened to you as a child and a young adult that impacted your mental health that I need to know about?" And maybe this sounds facetious, maybe this sounds uneducated, but it was how I felt at the time. It was 2017 that I'm having this conversation. I said, "Donna, I don't know what you're talking about. You asked me to tell you about my life. I started at age 4 with some Disney memories. I got up to age 23. From 23 to 35, where I'm sitting right now, I've been traveling to different markets, working for different teams, presenting for different team presidents. Haven't had a problem at all. So what do you mean impacted my mental health?" I didn't understand the connection. There was 12 years. I said, "I've had a chemical imbalance the last 2.5 years waiting for chemicals to balance out my imbalance. What do you mean impacted my mental health?" And she gave me an analogy that a lot of sports people, you know, relate to, but I think everyday people who go to sporting events can find commonality. And she said, "If you had a front row seat as an NBA executive and you're wearing a nice suit for a basketball game, and these 7-foot athletes are running up and down and they're coming by the side of the court as they do, and the sweat is flying off and hitting them and hitting you in your suit, or they dive for a loose ball and they land in your lap, your suit's going to get all sweaty. You're going to go home after that 3-hour game. You're going to put your suit away for the dry cleaner. You're going to put on a nice new suit the next day after showering and come in like you were never sweat on before." She said, "You had a front row seat. It wasn't for an NBA basketball game. It was for the game of life. And the game of life was represented by a muddy wrestling ring that your brother was fighting in, and a muddy wrestling ring that your friends were fighting in, and then all these other muddy wrestling rings that were nearby that you weren't paying as much attention to, but that you knew were happening. And you knew these wrestling matches were going on. It's not that you didn't know your brother was sick. Not that you didn't know your friends were dealing with some cardiovascular issues. You knew that was happening, but you were focused on everything else in the arena, the Jumbotron and the LED lights and the music. The equivalent there being an athlete growing up and submerging yourself in sports, working in the sports field, and then, you know, being an executive and moving to these different teams. That what you didn't notice is the mud was splattering from those wrestling matches as your brother was wrestling the game of life and your friends were wrestling the game of life. And it built up on you, the mud splattering, and hit you. That's called vicarious trauma. It builds up in your body and your central nervous system over time. It makes these physiological and biological changes to the way you think, the way you feel, the way you function. You didn't know that. And so for you, you're thinking, "I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. Now I'm sick when I'm 35. That's not what happens. It's a buildup over time. And when I heard that, my reaction to her was, "That doesn't make sense," right? I said, "Logically, it makes sense, but it doesn't make sense for society, because if that's what mental health is for society, take me out of the equation at 35. Take your average 15-year-old. If all we need is to have a front row seat to watch things happen to other people in our lives, okay, the 15-year-old who watches their parents get into fights and get a divorce, watches their parents lose their job and lose the house, watches their two best friends get into a fight and never speak to each other again, and you're the friend that's caught in the middle dealing with the awkwardness of that. Watching your friend deal with the sickness of a loved one or a loss of a loved one, or them being bullied on the schoolyard or verbally abused by an adult, or them confiding in you that they're being sexually abused. So I don't know a 15-year-old, let alone 35, 55-year-old, 85-year-old who hasn't been through one summer, many of those things. If that's what mental health is, everyone's mental health is impacted, and that's not the message that's out there." And she said, "Eric, you're right. I agree with you, but you're very passionate about this, and we need to get you healthy first." So she sends me to this weekend breathing course. I'm the only man, only one under 40, and only one born in this country. So it's me and 8 Indian women and 9 yoga mats. I'm a complete fish out of water. But I start learning about the process of breath and the importance of structures in the body, like the vagus nerve, and how we lose things like vagal tone, and how doing rhythmic breathing patterns starts to repair some of the damage that, I'll give a very case in point example. Michael, if you and I were in a room and a car crashed outside of the room, we would hear the sound and we go, "Oh!" Well, we're changing the way we're breathing. And now the structure of the vagus nerve, which goes from the brainstem down to the stomach, these two branches would go from being this rubber band type of material to strict, like these two rulers. Well, that means you're losing vagal tone, right? The ability for your brain and your body to communicate with one another. Well, doing a rhythmic breathing pattern brings back that vagal tone, right? And so I started doing that pattern. That's only one of the many modalities that are out there. We can go deeper into the other ones that are there. And I start feeling better, not right away, not a week into it, not 3 weeks into it, 30 days into doing the practice every single day, my brain starts to come back online. And I start going, wow, I want to have scrambled eggs for breakfast. I want to watch the news on TV. This is amazing. I haven't felt this in so long. And that little bit of excitement coming back, and I would say my brain coming back online, was what gave me the desire to keep pushing and keep going. And I immersed myself into this. This will fully answer your question. Well, what do I want to do now that my brain is working again? I haven't worked for 2.5 years. Like, I've been out of it as these doctors gave me 52 different meds and I was dysfunctional. And I went on all the largest nonprofit websites for mental health in this space. And I said, okay, I've got relationships in the sports world. People in sports have large platforms. I'm happy to make introductions to whoever is talking about this topic in a way that I just came to understand it. That life builds up inside of us. It starts to make these physiological and biological changes. There's exercises we need to do to heal and get to better spots. Who's talking about it this way? And I go to all these websites and I see the same three messages on all these websites that were there in 2017. It's 2024 now. We just passed May. Nothing has changed. And those three messages are, the first is 1 in 5 people are mentally ill. The second you start with that statistic, doesn't matter if it's 1 in 5, 2 in 5, 3 in 5, or even 4 in 5, you've made the topic binary. There's a group of people who have it, and there's a group of people who don't. So you're telling this group of people, whatever that percentage is, hey, guess what? There's a group of people in society who are healthy, fine, normal, okay. There's nothing wrong with them. So those people are going to tune it out and not listen to the message. That's number one. Second thing is, the most popular campaign for normalization is an action word followed by stigma. So stop the stigma, stomp the stigma, break the stigma, race the stigma. Football has kicked the stigma. Hockey has slapped the stigma. Baseball has strike out the stigma. You see where I'm going with this. Yes. The term stigma means human beings are forming unfair opinions and judgments about other human beings. It doesn't mean this tea that I'm holding or this book in front of me is forming an unfair opinion judgment. It means human beings. So when I say stop, break, it's a great venting tool. Yes, I want to make sure it goes away. But it's being pointed at another group of people. That takes this binary idea of some have it and some don't, and it pulls them even further apart because they're at odds with each other. Look at all the things that are going on socially right now. Israel versus Palestine, Ukraine versus Russia. When you say, you stop doing this, that doesn't, oh, okay, I'll stop. That's not what happens. Yeah. They dig their heels in even more, right? So that's number two. And then number three was all the way in which the celebrity stories are shared. This is still a huge issue. You're not alone. Britney Spears has depression too. She's part of the 1 in 5 group. You're not alone. Lindsay Lohan, she's part of the 1 in 5. She's got anxiety. Well, okay, how do you learn about what happens when they have anxiety and depression? You click on the link that takes you to the Us Weekly or People Magazine article. Britney Spears has depression. She shaves her head. Lindsay Lohan has anxiety. She dresses like a hot mess. Kanye West has bipolar, says crazy things about his family, right? So add up these three messages that are still the biggest billboards in all of mental health. It's for 1 in 5 people. We need to stop stigmatizing that poor group of 1 in 5. And if you want to know if you're in that group of 1 in 5, do you shave your head? Do you run off the basketball court in panic attacks like Kevin Love? And do you think you could run for president like Kanye West? How many people are raising their hand going, yeah, that's a group I'm a part of, right? And that's the reason why, as a society, even though we have the greatest awareness in the history of our planet of mental health because more people are talking about it, we also have the worst trends because we're talking about it in the wrong way. We're talking about it through the lens of labeling and disordering and putting people into buckets, into categories. We're not talking about the underlying source, which is emotional pain that comes through the challenging life events that we all have. So the name of the organization, Same Here, is an American Sign Language sign. It's Michael, you and I were the same. I don't know your personal story yet, but I know that you're a human being, probably over the age of 8, though I'm sure it happens to people even younger than 8 years old and the stuff that they go through when they watch things in their household with their parents. You've been through challenging life events because you're a human. I've been through challenging life events. That's impacted both of our mental health.
Yeah.
The topic's for 5 and 5, not for 1 and 5, and it lives across a continuum instead of it being binary. That's the message society needs to be educated with for people to be proactive to work on their mental health so that we don't have these trends of suicides and overdoses the way that we have. But we're not there yet. So that's been my work the last 6 or 7 years of getting that message out there, using the nonprofit as our messaging umbrella, and then bringing programming to schools and offices and, you know, churches and colleges and service departments. We're going to Seoul, South Korea to bring this to military bases. Like, it's just amazing the opportunities that you get when you start talking about it in a real way.
Yeah, that was a great answer. That pumped me up because I live with bipolar disorder too. And, you know, it affects my whole family. So it just doesn't affect me. It affects everyone. And then, like you said, when I first was diagnosed, I Googled celebrities and exactly what you said. That's what I saw. So how important is it to hear other lived experiences with, you know, people like us succeeding?
Yeah, well, I love that question, and I want to, if you're comfortable with it, Michael, I want to just say people like us, right?
Yeah.
You're looking at it through the lens of bipolar, okay? Let's get a little broader than that because that's the importance of hearing the stories, right? Yes. So now let's look at the term bipolar and let's break it down a little more specifically. So when did you start experiencing the symptoms of what you would consider to be bipolar? Around what age would you say you were?
I would say early 20s.
Early 20s. Okay. Do you think, Michael, that you had this lap of luxury, everything was great, I'm on top of the world life from age 0 to age 20?
No, not at right? all.
Okay. So we look at bipolar, and when we're talking about sharing our stories, I think this is an important emphasis, and I hope this is collaborative, what I'm sharing here, and this makes you feel good. Question is, like, one of my best friends is a guy named Robin Lehner, played goalie for the New York Islanders, the Ottawa Senators, the Buffalo Sabres, the Chicago Blackhawks, the Vegas Golden Knights. He's had to take off the last couple of years because of physical injuries. But the reason he joined our organization and wears the hashtag on his helmet is because he was diagnosed with bipolar. Okay, I'm using air quotes. You'll see why in a second.
Okay.
Because no one got to know him, the individual, that he grew up in Sweden, that his mom was absent from the family, that his mom and dad didn't get along, that he grew up essentially in a single-parent household, that his dad, to make ends meet, was traveling to all different parts of Eastern Europe to be a fighter. That was his only way of making money, to use his hands as his way of bringing in income. So Robin's like grown up without parents, gets thrust into, when I say thrust, look, extremely talented big guy, but at 17, 18 years old, he's in Ottawa, Canada, which is a completely different part of the world than Sweden, playing goalie with all this pressure on him to perform because he's supposed to be this phenom. No one's ever taught him coping mechanisms. So he gets diagnosed with bipolar, but the story itself is what happened to you, right? Because there's an underlying piece of what we call stress and trauma that builds and builds and builds and dysregulates the nervous system that then leads to, now I'm going to say bipolar through a different lens, the symptoms of bipolar,
yeah.
Right? So you as Michael, you're not this person who's got a disease of bipolar. You're someone whose genes express themselves in such a way that get categorized based on the stress trauma build over time as, well, yours is called bipolar. And then here's what ends up happening, Michael, is because mine got labeled as PTSD or CPTSD, chronic PTSD, then all of a sudden we get into this game of, well, you've got bipolar, I've got PTSD. We don't exactly understand what each other's going through. That's ridiculous. The commonality of telling our stories, as you heard what happened with my brother, you didn't have a brother who went through the exact same thing my brother did, but you heard sickness of family members. You heard organ transplant. You heard cancer. You heard hospitalizations. You heard injuries. Those are things that are human that happen to all of us, right? And so it welcomes you into the conversation through my own vulnerability when I share that, that when you share your story of 0 to 20 before this concept of bipolar even comes in, now we're all part of the same team. Now it's same here, right? And so I think the challenge in this space, to answer your question, is it is super important we tell our stories. But if athletes and then those of us who are everyday people off of athletes or off of celebrities tell our stories and it's only through the lens of disorder, it never normalizes the conversation, right? Because the 1 in 5 of us who get diagnosed, yeah, it normalizes it for them. Even within that 1 in 5, back to the bipolar versus PTSD, we feel like we're in separate categories within the 1 in 5, but what are we telling all the other 4 in 5 people? They believe they're the healthy, fine, normal, okay group, yeah. And they never work on themselves, and then eventually their nervous system becomes dysregulated. So I think storytelling is vitally important, but I think doing it through the lens of what did the build look like, and then what did it feel like for the symptom onset to come on? That's what welcomes people in, as opposed to, I deal with bipolar, this is what my day-to-day looks like. If we start there, I think we're going to leave the majority of the population out who's going to go, this topic doesn't apply to me.
Yeah, what I try to say is I have 42 years of emotional experience.
Yes.
Because that's, everyone goes through emotion.
You nailed it, man. And how long have we been told... Men, you can talk about specifically, but I think it applies to women too, to be fair. Maybe not as much so, but you're told for so long, don't express your emotions.
Yeah.
Expressing your emotions is a sign of weakness. I know it's cliche to say that out loud, but I think the more we have those conversations, it's important. And the X's and O's of what that looks like of holding on to your emotions. Okay, well, yeah, we'll let you be emotional when you get mad, when you get angry at someone. That's an okay emotion to happen. But if something bad happens to someone in your family, Michael, you can't cry. If you cry, your team members on your team are going to see that. That's a sign that you can't hold down the fort when bad things happen. No, that's not true. That's you being a human being. That's you showing that you care about other people. That doesn't mean that you crawl up into a ball and that you can't function. That means that it impacted you and now it's motivating you for what the next thing is. And so there's this rebrand that has to happen of what does emotional, you know, truthfulness look like? What does being open and honest and sharing look like? And that's where we are our healthiest, when we are that way. And unfortunately, that's not the message that most of us get as young kids and then as we start to get into adulthood.
Yeah, what are some of the initiatives you work on?
Yeah, so... you know, we a number of different ones. So first is we have 5 different programs. So I was mentioning a little bit about them before. So our K-12 program we call Same Here Schools. Our college program we call Same Here Sit Downs. Our corporate office program we call Same Here Safe, because people don't feel safe talking about this in an office setting. Our service department programs, not surprisingly because the S, we call Same Here Service. And then our sports team and leagues program, again, because the S, we call Same Here Sports. In each one of those programs, we go into organizations like consultants and we bring sequential presentations and workshops that dive into the nuance of what mental health is, how do you establish common language, how do you learn the science behind how challenging life events, what you were saying, the emotional experience over those 42 years, how do those impact our physiology and our biology? What coping mechanisms do we unfortunately turn to that are maladaptive, and why do we turn to them? The drinking, the drugging we all know about, but sex and gambling and hoarding and cutting and vaping and shopping and all the things that come on that list. And then finally, something that we call STAR exercises, which is an acronym, stands for stress and trauma, active release and rewiring, right? So think of how we were taught about plaque building our arteries and having heart attacks. As little kids, as complicated of a concept as that is, they simplified it down and they did jump rope for heart and hoops for heart. And they said, plaque builds silently from what you eat and you sitting around. So you need to get up and be active so that you burn the plaque in your arteries so you don't have the heart attack when you get older. Same thing applies with stress and trauma in our nervous system. So STAR, stress and trauma, which builds in our nervous system, we need to do A, activities, to 2 R's, release and rewire it out. And so we call it the gym for the brain of all these different evidence-based practices, from tapping to havening to EMDR to brain spotting to neurofeedback, all these different exercises that start to work on these affected parts of the brain and the body connection. How do we start to heal? And so we do that in person through these programs, and then we have an app. The app is called Same Here Scale. And it takes the concepts of what I just shared and it puts them in the palm of your hands, right? So think about this for a second. Take mental health out of it. In every other aspect of health, physical health, this is what the chronology is. We measure something in a range, and then based on where we fall in that range, we do something about it. So you step on a scale. You either like the range that you're in or you don't. You're either way too less and you haven't been eating enough, or you weigh too much and you don't like what your habits have been, and you do something about it. You go to the gym, you start eating healthier. You put a blood pressure cuff on you. You're either high or you're low. You make changes based on how high or low you are, the activities. You put a thermometer in your mouth for something short term. Your temperature's either high or it's normal, or sometimes it's even low. You do something about resting or taking an over-the-counter like a Tylenol, okay? Blood sugar levels, high or low. You have to change what your dietary habits are. I mean, every single thing that we do in health is a range, but yet somehow we were taught mental health, you either have it or you don't. It's not in a range, and that's not true. So we show a range of answers, which is based off of a science that's called polyvagal, and the range is a scale. It's emoji faces on a scale: thriving, gliding, surviving, fluctuating, struggling, sinking. And underneath each one of those 6 places on the scale, it lists the thoughts, the feelings, and the behaviors that often come in underneath each one of those places. How can I possibly know that when I don't know an individual person? How can I blanketly make that statement? Because the way that our nervous system shifts is it shifts in a very linear way, right? So we go to this place of oversympathetic nervous system response where we're hypervigilant and we think, oh my God, something might happen. I'm fearful of this. We saw a lot of people go through that during COVID. What if we never get a job back again? What if we're never able to go back in the office? What if my hours are cut? What if my job is cut? To eventually a place where I was for that 2.5-year period, this shutdown of our nervous system, because the sympathetic response was so dominant for so long, the system goes, I'm done. And Michael, I'm sure with having bipolar, you've experienced what that shutdown feels like when the nervous system says, sorry, Mike, like I've been way too maxed out for so long. I got to check out right now, because if you start continuing to think over and over and over again the way that you have before, we're not going to be able to continue to function anymore. So it literally pulls the plug on you. That linearity and learning that is power, because once you learn that, you don't go, I'm Mike, the guy with bipolar, and I'm screwed because I have bipolar the rest of my life. You go, I'm Mike, who's in this freezing phase, we call it sinking, of my nervous system. Guess what, though? I can do exercises and lifestyle changes that get me back to a better place on that scale. Still living with symptoms of bipolar, but not locked into this place where I can't function. And that's where we have to change it. So the Same Here Scale, the reason specifically why we call it Same Here Scale and not Calm or Headspace, which are great names for apps, don't get me wrong, but we want people to be thinking about, oh, my mental health moves in a range. Where am I at? Let me track that range. Based on that range, let me do some exercises like I would for my physical body to get myself back to a better place on that range. That's the only way we can proactively work on our mental health. If not, then we're at risk of going, things are bad, things are bad, things are bad, things are bad. What doctor do I go to fix me? Okay, did that doctor fix me? Did they not? I got to go to the next doctor. Well, we don't ever do that with physical health. We don't go, There's no such thing as eating better. There's no such thing as going to the gym. So I'm screwed unless this doctor gives me a medication to fix me. Medication's part of the equation, but it's not the only part of the equation. And that's where we're at with mental health right now. And that's totally got to change.
How has the organization helped your own mental health?
Yeah, you know what? Being able to tell my story on an everyday... Some people say to me, you know, is it hard telling your story over and over again? And no, it's a privilege, right? It's a privilege because I hold on to these things that happened to me, and then I know that I'm using my story to help others for them to be able to relate. Now, the average person telling their story over and over again in a therapist's office is not productive when it's for yourself because you're just re-ingraining the trauma over and over again.
Right.
Fortunately, I've done the work that I've gotten away from it enough now that retelling it doesn't re-traumatize me. So the first piece is when I'm able to use my story to be of service to others, it's tremendously rewarding, right? That's number one. The second thing is I am so lucky that I get to be surrounded by these global practitioners who've come up with all these brilliant modalities or have researched these ancient brilliant modalities that have been out there for so long and be a sponge to just take in all of their knowledge to understand how the nervous system works, to understand why these different modalities heal. And so for me, when I track myself on that same here scale and I get to a spot where I'm red, sinking, I don't freak out as much as I used to. If you notice my answer there, I didn't say I don't freak out at all because that's human. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
But I don't freak out as much as I used to because I go, okay, Eric, this is a phase. Look at where you were the last time you were here. It didn't last forever. Even though it feels like it's going to last forever, it's not. These are the things that you did. It tracks the activities that you did underneath each of your places on the scale so that you were able to get yourself out of that spot. And that gives me hope. So I think when I struggled from 2015 to 2017, no one was talking about this stuff. I was going through what was called dorsal vagal shutdown of that nervous system. But to me, I'd never heard those terms before. I didn't know what a nervous system dysregulation was. And so I thought I had a nervous breakdown and my brain will never be the same again. A chemical imbalance where the chemicals have been messed up and I'm never going to be chemically the same again. Okay, well, you're screwed when you're in that pattern, because your sympathetic nervous system response continues to stay up because you're waking up every single day going, I'm damaged. There's something wrong with me. I can't ever get better. You can't get out of that cycle. So it's given me the opportunity, one, through telling my story and helping others, two, through the tools that I picked up from the smart folks that I listen to be able to build my own gym for my brain routine and to have agency over how I feel and to say, there's some miserable places that I still get to, but it's not a forever feeling, and I can work my way out of it.
Earlier, you talked about Kevin Love, who is open with his mental health, but I'm guessing he is not the only one with mental health issues in all of sports. How important is athletes to talk and express their mental health while, you know, playing in a stressful environment?
So important. There's the timing of your question is really interesting because there's a clip that went viral on SportsCenter of a gentleman named Jabari Parker.
Yes.
Was the number two overall pick in the 2014 NBA draft out of Duke, played for Milwaukee at first, and then bounced around the league to five teams. Now he's out of the league and he's playing overseas in Spain. And, you know, they're very matter-of-fact, the reporters in Spain, not that they're not here, but they're like, Jabari, what's it like, year one, playing overseas? What's it like playing and living overseas? And you see him, and, like, there's this lump in his throat, and he starts tearing up. And I looked at that, and I don't know Jabari personally. There's a lot of athletes I do know personally. I don't know Jabari. I know people who know him. But it's human to look at that man and his reaction to go, that question just brought up 10 years of expectations.
Yeah.
When you're the second overall pick, your impression of where you're going to be 10 years from now is that you're going to be Scottie Pippen, right? Not that he was the second overall pick, right? But I'm thinking that type of player, like you're going to be in this pantheon of Jersey being retired and French, and now you're playing overseas only 10 years later, and the gravity of how that hits you. And so people might say on the outside, boo-hoo, he's getting paid millions of dollars to play a sport. It's not that simple. When you have these expectations for yourself, and then all of a sudden this is where you end up, the gravity of what your expectations were and how that grabs you for your life, that's heavy, right? So his is one example. But now here's the thing, Michael, and I'm going to be very open about this. I don't know that the way that Kevin Love has shared his story has been helpful to the conversation. Mm-hmm. I think it opened up the door for people to talk, but I'll ask you this. Do you know anything about Kevin Love's mental health other than that he had anxiety and a panic attack and ran off the basketball court? Like, what do you know about his life? Back to your question, from age 0 to 20. What do you know about Kevin's life from age 0 to 20 when he was playing at UCLA? Do you know anything?
No. And I follow his nonprofit, and it doesn't go into that detail.
Okay. So now let's flip that. I gave you the Jabari Parker. I'm inferring. Let's give it to someone who's actually open about it and who I work with. So I'm biased, but I reached out to him, and I wanted to work with him, and he's become one of my best friends. There's a gentleman named Theo Fleury. You may remember that name from the NHL. Why did I reach out to Theo? Why did I want him to be part of our organization? Because he wasn't standing up there when he was first telling his story. Before I ever shared mine, to his credit, he was saying, before Kevin Love, he wasn't saying, I'm Theo Fleury with PTSD. He said, I'm Theo Fleury, and I was raped over 150 times by my male coach when I was 16 years old. And it led me to drinking and drugging and sexing and gambling my $50 million that I made in the NHL completely away, because I had no coping mechanisms. No one taught me any of those things, and I didn't feel comfortable sharing with anyone any of those things that had happened to me as a kid. So I had to use those other tools because I had no idea how to live life on life's terms. That is a healing message. That's a healing story. That brings people together. And that's the type of stories we need from everyday athletes. And everyday athletes who are currently playing are very afraid to share that level of vulnerability. Why? Because when someone's guarding you on the court or on the ice or on the field, they're going to go, hey, Mike, your coach raped you. How are you feeling right now? You still thinking about him in your mind, right? And as effed up as that is to do to another human being, when you got millions of dollars at stake, these guys, these gals will do anything. Look at what just happened with, Caitlin Clark, right? Yeah. Getting run into. You looking for a whatever the reason is people have behind it, the takeaway I want to give there is competitive is competitive, and you want to rip the other person's throat out oftentimes. And sometimes it gets out of hand. So people are afraid when they share their vulnerabilities openly, that's going to be taken advantage of. And so that's where we need these strong individuals stepping up and going, I'm putting my story out there and I'm owning it, and nothing you can say to me is going to take me down because I've overcome that.
Yeah.
And I know how strong I am because I've overcome that.
That I, when you're talking, I kind of think of what goes through my life. And when I tell my story, I usually talk about just being diagnosed, but you're right, is, you know, when I was 8, my parents divorced and they had me when they were both 17. So they were in their mid-20s, and then I had, you know, two sides, whole different life and all that. So that's actually where the story starts instead of the diagnosis.
That's it, Mike. Like, what you just shared with me, 50% of marriages end in divorce. You start your story with divorce, Mike. You've just invited 50% of the population to come in and go, I want to hear more about this because my parents got divorced too. You start your story with, here's my bipolar, here's my diagnosis. 3%, 5% of the population are listening to what you're saying, right? Yeah. So how do we welcome people in through what we went through? That's the lens we got to look at it at. And unfortunately, we're taught by the powers that be, no, mental health is depression, anxiety, PTSD, bipolar, OCD. It's not. That's the end. That's the end of the spectrum of what happens symptomatically. Where your dysregulation came from is really what your story is.
What do you do to help your own mental health?
Yeah, so that star exercises that I shared, I have a whole routine. I do certain breath work. I do a lot of yoga stretches. I don't want to make it seem like I'm this, you know, so well, compliant person, right? I've got my app that I'm tracking myself to hold myself accountable in. I do a lot of tapping. I do a lot of something that's called havening, which is emotional technique for dampening amygdala function. All of those are productive for releasing and rewiring that stress and trauma from my system. And here's the kicker is life continues to happen. That brother that I shared, he's still alive, but he was just in the hospital last week because they're afraid his kidney that he has for my father may be failing again. Knock on wood, he just got released today. But life continues to happen. And if I don't continue to work on myself, that stress trauma level builds. It doesn't go away. And that's the binary thing that I want to share with everyone is just because I got over that awful 2.5 year stretch, that doesn't mean I don't still deal with mental health. My mental health is as messed as anyone's out there, right? I mean that in like a self-deprecating way. I don't mean that in a derogatory way. If I don't do these things, and here's my pattern, Mike, like my maladaptive coping mechanism, it's not drugs, it's not alcohol, it's not gambling. It's something that people applaud me for, and they shouldn't. It's my work ethic. My work ethic is an addiction, though. I'm up till 3 a.m. and I'm writing emails and I'm checking things out on websites. Guess what that's doing? That's not allowing me to do the work that you're asking me what I do to work on my mental health. Why? Because I get this dopamine hit from feeling good about the work that I'm doing, which covers up the feeling of the pain of the stress trauma build that's happening. And I need to be an adult and go, that's not good, Eric. Stop doing this and start doing more of these. So my star exercises are what I do. And then what I would encourage people to do on top of their own star exercise type of work, 2 different types of doctors, or I should call them practitioners more than doctors. One is functional medicine. There's so much that happens in the gut, in our lifestyle, in the way that we eat, that these are things that it's very hard to learn on your own. Things like an MTHFR gene mutation, and that means you need to have methylated vitamin B12 in order to make neurotransmitters. Who learns this stuff? Everyday people don't, but a functional medicine doctor can help you understand that. So you need supplementation of the methylated vitamin B12. How much sunlight am I getting versus blue light? And what is the ratio of that look like, right? Is my gut porous, and can I take a stool sample test that tells me that I either have gut dysbiosis, which is overgrowth, or leaky gut, which means that I'm not absorbing nutrients the way that I need to. So functional med is another important piece of this. And the other important piece, look, this might be hippity-dippity to some people. To me, I believe in it, is energy work. And I don't mean energy work like spiritual energy. I mean energy work like quantum energy, that there's energy that runs in and out of our body. There's science that I breathe in oxygen, I eat foods that get broken down into glucose, my oxygen and my glucose combine in this, factory in my cell that's called a mitochondria, and ATP, adenosine triphosphate, is this 3-form bond that I have that becomes ADP, adenosine diphosphate, that allows energy to go throughout my system. I need to work on how to get that energy flowing so I don't get things like chronic fatigue and run down, which happens to me all the time, by the way. I'm not saying I'm immune to it. So there's a lot of work that needs to get done. And I think what we do as a society is we get older, right? You're in your 40s now. I'm in my 40s now. And we go, oh, things aren't supposed to be as exciting because I experienced them already. I'm not supposed to have as much energy because I'm older now. Injuries are supposed to happen because why are we giving into that? We're giving into that because there's work to be done to not have those things happen to us. And most people are not willing to do that work to feel better. You see this, we've all been to the gym and seen the 70, 80-year-old person who's doing pull-ups. How, you see the person at the pickleball court and you see the person that's the grandparent pushing the grandchild, and they have more energy than the parent does. How does that happen? Okay, part of it's genetics, but part of it is they did the work that this whole system they took care of. And I think that's what we really need to push people to start doing is it's not just physical, it's mental. The two of them are connected. And if we could be proactive about it, we can live our best lives.
Where do you want to see your mission in the next 3 to 5 years?
It's the chicken or the egg or the million-dollar question for us is we formed the organization as a nonprofit. Nonprofits spread through word of mouth and grassroots.
Yeah.
Eventually, you can get funding and grants. Still limited. We put the app in a for-profit bucket based on it being recommended to us so that we could eventually, I don't want to say definitively because I don't want to lock myself into it, but if you take investors, I would only take them something that's called impact investors. I wouldn't go the traditional venture capital route, and I wouldn't go the route of private equity and stuff like that. To me, you got to find people who believe in your mission and say, I understand what you're trying to do. Money's important to us. And yes, we're investing in you so we can make money, but we see what you're trying to do to educate people. So if you ask me, I could have taken investments in this 3 years ago, 5 years ago. I didn't. I've held off this long because I wanted to build this in the way that I think people need to get it. And if I take that investment, my fear is that people are going to go, really cute idea, Eric, that everyone has mental health and you want to educate all them. Now, can you do me a favor and do the math on who the sick people are so you can tell them that they're sick and you have something that can fix them? That goes in the same cycle, right? Back to Mike's got bipolar, Eric's got PTSD. Those are the people that are the 1 in 5. Tell them that you've got a solution for them. I will never subscribe to that model. So the answer to your question is I'd like to be a brand with tools that is known for helping to educate the normalization of how mental health applies to everyone and as part of our everyday conversations and talks, and give people tools and resources like we have a gym on every corner. There should be a gym for our brain in every pocket. That's where we're getting to. And that might take more years than less, and that's okay if I have grayer hairs than not when it happens. I don't want to just sell out to the man or the woman because there's a certain amount of money to be made and I want to go retire on a yacht. That's not my goal. My goal is to use the brand to help as many people as possible.
Yeah. How can people reach out and learn more?
So a number of different ways. Our website is really simple. So it's Same Here. If anyone is seeing the visual on the screen, or I don't know if it's you're listening through audio. So samehereglobal.org. So it's a .org, not a .com. On that site, tons of resources from our different alliances and the different practices within STAR to be able to look at there. So that's the first one. Stories of celebrities sharing their challenging life events. Our social media channels listed up here again are at Same Here, SAMEHERE underscore global. And to see tens of thousands of people together on these channels, Instagram is probably our most active. I've started to do more videos. I used to just do posts and write things, and then people got on me and said, you got to put your voice out there. People need to see the person behind the brand, Eric. I know you write very personally, but so I've started to do more videos, but it's an accepting community where people can talk about anything from, I just went through a divorce, to my family member's sick, to I'm getting moved and my job is really difficult because I'm going to have to make all new friends after being an adult in this market for so long. That's a place that we need, that safety, that you can come, that there's no judgment, that you can open up and share. And so I hope people will visit us that way. I hope people download the app. It's free. There's a premium version, but you can start tracking for free, doing your trends over time at Same Here, one word, and then Scale, second word. Apple, App Store, Android Store, please download that and start using it. It'd be great to have more and more folks in the community.